Survivor's Guide to True Crime includes discussions of sexually based violence and is not intended for children. Information provided should not be used as a substitute for professional medical or legal advice. Please exercise discretion and self-care.
Welcome back to Survivor's Guide to True Crime. I'm Kim.
And I'm Kara. We have a really special episode today. This is the one that we've been promising you all season. It's finally here. It's our Q&A and like our chance to just talk about whatever the heck we want episode.
So it's just going to be Kara and I today. No special guests, even though we think we're pretty special.
My mom says I'm special.
I mean, you are. It's okay.
I know. Last night, we got to do a live on our Patreon. It was exclusive to our Patreons. It was a little bit of a learning curve. I'm looking forward to not having such a lag next time now that we worked out some of the kinks. And it was so fun. It went real fast.
It does. Yeah, that's one thing I've found whenever I do lives that are scheduled for a certain amount of time. It flies by when you're the one that's actually doing the live. Sometimes it doesn't feel like that when you're consuming it. I hope that it flew by for everyone that was consuming it. And I hope that this hour flies by for you guys, too.
Well, and I like just getting to answer questions from people in real time without worrying about like bots or trolls or anything like that, right? It was just such a nice, relaxed, laid back kind of thing. And we meant to have it just be funny and hearty hard like we usually banter back and forth. But we got into some tough subjects and it was great because then it wasn't just us supporting each other. It was the commenters and our patrons that are finding community and support with each other too. So I was really happy with how it went and loved that it was an ice cream social. Everybody ended up bringing ice cream.
Yes, it was a totally random comment from one of our patrons who said that she was bringing ice cream. And I was like, we totally need to make it an ice cream social. So that's what we did. We all brought our ice cream and our comfy cozies and we just hung out. And we hope that that's what this episode is. So, you know, if you want to pause right now and go get yourself some ice cream and make this your ice cream social, that sounds great. I'm finishing my coffee, so I will not be joining you for ice cream at the moment. But we would love to have you for our next ice cream social over on Patreon if you would like to join us.
So I just listened back to our episode with the Murder Diaries, Paige and Natalie. I loved that conversation. And it was different than what we typically do here because we have other people that we don't necessarily know that are moving this along who are also part of the industry. But I really liked that conversation because it didn't focus as much on our crimes. And it was like all the things that we keep talking about that need to happen happened. And so they sent us the episode ahead of time to listen to and review, just like we do with all of our guests. And I just finished that right before we hopped on here to record. And I loved it. It was fun. So I'm going to take the role this time of interviewing you for a little bit.
Oh,
yeah. So this question comes from one of our listeners. And it says, so I've been listening to the podcast episodes and it has me wondering, for how many survivors who felt fine and like nothing was wrong, was having kids the catalyst to their healing journey? And how the heck do you heal while raising your mini-me's who can be walking little triggers at times without also causing them trauma? Inquiring minds want to know.
Yeah, so I love this question. This is actually from a friend of mine who's also a listener who messaged me and sent me this question. And I thought, this is so perfect. I absolutely want to address this on the podcast. So I saw a fantastic video somewhat recently about this exact topic. I'm sure it's because the algorithm knew that I had been talking about this. And so I'm going to kind of summarize what that video said and add a little bit of my own content into it. The video that I saw essentially said that we as humans develop these coping mechanisms that get us through life. And a lot of the time, those coping mechanisms can keep us at an equilibrium, or if we're lucky, it can keep us slightly above an equilibrium. And then whenever we have kids, those coping mechanisms that we developed, suddenly they aren't enough because we have increased stress. So it's kind of like you're in a boat and you have a certain number of people and then you just get like another person in the boat. And it's like, hey, man, your boat's going to sink now. This boat cannot hold up this number of people. And I always think of the Jim Gaffigan quote where he said, what is it like having, it's four.
Oh, I use this quote all the time.
Like, it's like you're drowning and someone throws you a baby. Like, that's basically what happens is, you know, you develop, whether it's after your first child or your fourth child, at some point, the amount of stress you're under exceed these coping mechanisms that were great for you for a long time. So I think that is why so many people experience that they're good and then they have kids and they're like, I'm not good. Because all of a sudden, all of the things that you've kind of been squishing down and not dealing with, you can't squish them down anymore.
Right.
So what's your input on that?
because it was somewhat directed at you, I hadn't quite thought about it or formed my thoughts surrounding it. My kids weren't triggers for me. They did magnify the work that I still needed to do and the type of parent that I wanted to be. That I probably, if I were not a survivor, would not have looked at my parenting through that lens. I remember an advocate from another agency talking to me during my first pregnancy, and she had mentioned that some survivors are triggered when they go through the birth process. And that thought had never even crossed my mind. But I will say now, on this side of it, I can see how that would happen. For me, I've realized it was because what happened in college with a stranger breaking into my apartment, I knew that it was the black and white line that had been crossed. I knew that it was a crime. And I also knew that that was not sex, right? There is a difference when I get up and talk and give my presentation and somebody's like, when did you feel comfortable having sex again? I said, just to point out, you all realize this entire speech, I have not talked about having sex. I haven't talked about sex at all. I've talked about rape. I've talked about sexual assault. I've talked about sexually based violence. I've not talked about sex. And drawing that delineation is really important. So for me, birth was not a trigger because there was not that blurred line. Now I would say I would look at it a little differently, but I've had, luckily, positive interactions with the medical community. So I don't think that that was necessarily it. It's all the things afterwards, which is exactly what this question gets to the heart of, right? Mini-me's can be triggers because when you see something that maybe you aren't 100% okay with in yourself being reflected back to you as something a child says, and it can be something funny like, oh, I say Jesus Christ all the time. And one of my children then repeated it. I'm like, ooh, that does not sound good coming from a child's mouth. It can be something as simple as that, or as large as, I understand that you're dissociating right now. Instead of talking about the icky feelings, how can we work around that? How can we make sure that we aren't co-regulating each other, but also working through this in a way that's positive, where you feel like you have autonomy over the human that you're becoming?
One of the things that I have heard people say that I think is just so paramount to this discussion is that they learned how to respond to their children instead of react.
Ooh.
And I think that is exactly where that nuance lies in this conversation, that if we have children and we find ourselves reacting to them, then that is an indicator that we still have healing to do. It's not easy when you're raising children. Trust me, as someone who solo parented during the majority of my healing, it's freaking hard. It's hard. But I will tell you, you most likely are not as alone as you think you are. You most likely have people who want to support you. And one of the things I had to learn was how to actually ask people for help and how to let people in and let them help me. Because my husband was out of the country. I had two little children. I realized I actually needed to heal. Like, I actually had things to heal. I was parenting out of a place of reacting all the time. And so I had to ask for help a lot. I had to let a lot of people help co-parent my children for all intents and purposes. And I think that that is the biggest thing that I found in my experience, whether that looks like physically having people to come and help you co-parent your children, having a therapist that can help you work through this, having a family therapist, having a religious community that helps you, having a community in general, whatever that looks like for you. That would be my biggest piece of advice here. So this conversation about children and co-parenting reminds me of a question that we got on the Patreon live, which was essentially, it feels so lonely doing this healing thing. How do I talk to my loved ones? And we took this in a couple of different ways, but I think the same context sort of applies in this scenario, whether it's the first time disclosing, that was one of the ways that we took this, or whether it's, I feel so alone. And the first thing that I said is, remember, this goes back to the conversation that Kim and I have about this podcast and everything that we do in our business. No one's going to work as hard for you as you are going to work for you. That is frustrating and it is exhausting, but like, no one else is going to heal you. It's not fair that someone else hurt you and now the burden of fixing someone else's screw up is that you have to do the work, but that's the way it is. So first and foremost, know that you can have people to help you and to guide you along that journey, but your therapist isn't going to heal you. Your therapist is going to help you find the spots that need to be healed and give you the tools to do that. You have to heal you. So I'm going to lay that groundwork and let you know like the bare truth first. But then the other side of that is that there are people in your life that want to support you. Having lost someone relatively close to me somewhat recently, that I literally would have walked to the ends of the earth for this person. And no one knew that he was struggling before he completed suicide. Knowing that he never told anyone how much help he needed, and we all would have done anything for him, tells me that you have people like that in your life as well. So if you feel lonely, find two or three people that are safe and say, I'm feeling lonely, I need help, and then tell them how they can help you. They want to help you. They want to support you. That conversation, more likely than not, is going to go better than you think it will. But if you give them the problem and the solution, and they love you, they want to help you, and they will.
It's also okay if you don't know exactly what you need. Say just that. I know that your loss was very recent. Mine was, 9 years ago. I thought about this a lot when we were doing Jazz's episode, and she was talking about all the hurdles that she had to overcome with surviving and instead starting to fight. And I just couldn't stop thinking about my best friend and cousin, Sherry. A lot of you have asked what my tattoo is on my wrist. It's my cousin Sherry's initials, who we lost to suicide back in 2014. And that rocked me to my core. I knew I needed therapy right away because I had already been in therapy, but I needed for something different. Like going through grief therapy is very different than what I had done before, but a lot of the same coping skills are going to apply here. You need to know how to sit with it, that it's okay to feel it and sit with it. And that's the first time anybody really gave me permission to do that. And it's, gosh, I still find myself doing it now and I'm very cognizant about it, but I think it's the same thing with loneliness. You have to give yourself permission to feel it and to name it. When Kara was having a hard time a month ago or whatever it was, and you put the word lonely to it, it was a release. And then you knew what to ask for. Sometimes we get so scared of the label that we're going to put on how we're feeling that we avoid doing it. And in such action, we completely miss the point and try to do all the things around it that aren't addressing the heart of the problem. So being able to communicate one or two safe people, a community that you find, even if it's online, somewhere to go where you can just be yourself is really important for bridging that gap. It's okay to reach out over and over. It's okay to ask for help. Now, what's different? And I just realized the sweatshirt that I'm wearing right now was Sherry's. I have, her mom gave me, my aunt gave me a lot of her clothes. My cousins and I all actually have a lot of her clothes and jewelry and different things, and I will not get rid of them. But sitting with this for a second, because I just got back from Illinois and drove by our headstone, and I didn't stop in the cemetery this time. Oh my God, what is happening?
Are you having feelings?
Oh, God damn it.
You can't say that.
Ew, I hate feelings.
I know. They're so inconvenient. So you're saying that you didn't feel them while you were there?
Oh, no, I totally did. But okay. When I was in Illinois last week, usually I'll go out to the cemetery and visit my grandparents, visit Sherry's headstone. And I didn't this time. And it was a cognitive choice because we weren't there for that long. Mike flew back earlier and I was there with my parents and the littles. And I realized that the ways that I think about her, honor her more at, you know, my aunt and uncle's pond or at the farmhouse or whatever it might be. And that I wanted to take the little time that I had to spend with those people who are still here instead of going there, because I can have that conversation with her anytime that I need to. And I know that's a little off topic, but now I'm feeling feelings. And this is apparently how this episode is going to go. Super. This is just what I wanted.
It's but. Just like our live. We were like, it's going to be lighthearted and fun. And we were like, nope.
So it's weird because it hits you in different waves. And that can be the same, not just of grief, but of trauma or grieving the person or the life that you thought you would have before something like this happened to you. it's okay to sit with it. I hate that I'm having to practice what I preach right now with a HD camera in my face. So you're welcome. Leading by example.
Hey, it's all right. Anytime I'm crying now, it's like a growth point for me because I hated people seeing me cry with such a fiery passion for so long.
Yep.
That now when I cry, I'm like, I am purposefully putting this on video. And, you know, that's also just that super duper stubborn side of me that's like, no, screw you, trauma. I'm not stubborn at all. That is like, I will not be controlled by this any longer. Mm-hmm. Right. And so like, no, I'm going to let people see me cry. So, you know, every time I cry, basically you see it.
Okay. I want to talk about this because I don't know if we've gotten to it yet. At some point we were taking notes throughout. Gosh, when did we start doing interviews? November?
Yeah.
Yeah. So ever since then, we've just thrown different things in our OneNote here to come back to. I don't know what brought this up, but let's talk about the shower that you had afterwards, because this stuck out to me. I'm like, what were we talking about here? But
oh yeah,
I feel like everyone knows, everyone remembers the shower that you had afterwards. So what was yours?
No shower hits the same in your entire life. It feels like everybody has had an opportunity where they've like just gone a little too long without a shower. And you take a shower, especially if you have ADHD and you've been putting it off for like an absurd amount of time. You're like, it's been a week since I've washed my hair. And then you take that shower and you're like, I feel like I lost 10 layers of skin and I feel like I have emerged a whole new human. It's like Daenerys coming out of the flames on Game of Thrones, like feel like a whole new human. And that is the closest I can equate that shower to after the sexual assault exam. I just remember it felt like, oh, I have the perfect analogy. Okay. You know, when your fingernails get to the point where you're like, okay, they're too long and you cut them and then you cut them and it feels so good. It feels so different. You don't know what I'm talking
about. Mine break before I ever get there.
Okay. But you know, like, or like your toenails, like when you cut them, you're like,
yep. Okay.
Great. You're like, it feels so much better. Oh, I feel like a different person. That's what that shower feels like to me.
I didn't have the same experience, I think. So I talk about this and I'm going to issue yet another trigger warning here. If you are listening or if there's kids present, please skip forward, turn it off. When my assailant completed his assault, he ejaculated up on my upper left thigh. We've talked about this in my episode. And for me, I had like this hyper focus on that spot because I knew immediately it was DNA. Somebody needed to swab it. That's where they were going to catch him from. I can point to exactly where it is on my leg at all times. And I didn't, it got swabbed in the SANE examination. I went to the department afterwards, gave my statements, and then I went back to my parents' house. And I'm not sure where the shower fell in the grand scheme of, I know I fell asleep on the couch for a little bit. I know I fell asleep eventually in my parents' bed. I don't remember eating anything, though I know that I did. So I can't remember where exactly the shower happened in that time frame, but I do remember being in there, having the water up hotter than any human should be able to stand, and scrubbing with a loofah and then a washcloth, that one spot. And I'm pretty sure I rubbed it raw and it didn't feel clean. And even when I got out of the shower, it was like, it didn't emerge from the flames for me. I'm still dirty. And it's not even that I was internalizing the shame that so many of us feel after maybe it's an assault by an acquaintance or date rape, inter partner violence, whatever it might be. I hadn't internalized that. And yet I still didn't feel like my body was mine. And I don't know when that changed. Maybe it didn't, because I still can point to that one spot right here on my leg that will never necessarily be clean. But I can look to it as a point that that's where the nail in the coffin went.
Yeah. You know, as you were talking, I realized that I think for me, that shower felt the same as fitness and skincare feel to me now in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
So I was dissociating through the sexual assaults, through the sexual assault exam. And then when I got home and I got in that shower, It's a little bit like it slams you back in your body. And so for me, it was that I'm here moment where the dissociation stopped for a minute. I don't remember a ton. I just remember it also feels a little bit like, because I'm so sensory, I'm like, what did it feel like? What did it feel like in my body? Because I can't connect a lot of emotions because of the dissociation. So, but I can tell you what it feels like. It also feels a little bit like when you've been on a road trip for a really long time and you've been holding it for way too long. And then you go to the bathroom and you're just like, oh God, that feels way better. You know, like that's kind of what it felt like too. So it kind of slammed me back into my body and made me realize a little bit what I was feeling physically, but not emotionally. I still have no idea what I felt emotionally during any of that time. It's a mystery.
That's a good point. Well, and you know, I'm sitting here listening to you talk. I'm a visual person. We've talked about this in our different things. So yours is definitely a feeling. Everybody's a kinesthetic learner. Let's lay that out there right now. I'm very visual in that as someone's telling a story or I'm putting something together, I'm seeing it on a storyboard with images and music. And like, it's basically how I edit in post-processing for videos. But really, it looks like for somebody that is creating a movie or a production, it looks like a visual storyboard to me. I didn't have my sense of sight during the assault. And so everything else was super heightened. And so now as I think back, I think that may be why I have such a good memory of all the things that happened afterwards, is because I didn't have it, the deprivation of visual stimuli during that time. Like I latched on to that blue hue of the dawn. I latched on to what I saw from here up and the video camera and his socks and shoes, and could talk about those in great detail because those were the only visuals that I had. And that may in part be part of the triggers too.
Yeah, that makes sense. I'm curious, if I had been deprived of my sense of sight, like how would I have encoded memories? You know, like right. Makes me wonder, because that's all I really have. I don't really have smells, sounds, emotions. I only have visual. I have no other sensory input, really. So it makes me wonder how that would have been different for me.
Yeah.
This is just so, I love these conversations. It's so interesting because it's like, this is why we think this podcast is important. These relationships, these communities are important, because it really does help you process things and think about it. Be like, oh yeah, what was I feeling? And like a therapist is great for that, but also having conversations with people who have been through similar situations. Like it's why support groups are a thing. Weird. It's like people know what they're talking about.
Well, and some things you're saying are jogging my memory. And let's also point out, we know that this is a safe place to work through those things, which is why our brains are more apt to learning while we're having these conversations. Where if you feel like you're having this conversation with somebody who doesn't understand, you're going to be more on guard and maybe not work all the way through those because you feel like you're going to be judged, or that it is not a safe place to open your mind up for that. It's another key piece of therapy. Make sure that you do feel safe.
Yeah, I mean, I've told you this before, and I still think it's funny that whenever I was picking my current therapist, I literally went on Psychology Today and I put in therapists that are specialized in complex PTSD and severe trauma and who do EMDR, and they all had their photographs. And I picked, I think like 10 to 15 that I was like, I like that person's face. They look like somebody I could talk to. I had literally judged all of the books by the cover. But I was like, if your face doesn't look like a face I want to talk to, then I'm not going to talk to you. And so then I messaged all of them. And out of the ones that responded, the ones who had responses that didn't annoy me, because let's face it, I'm an irritable, picky bitch. And like on a good day. And so the ones whose responses didn't irritate me, I picked out of those who my therapist would be. And I love her. She's fantastic. But it's like, you have to find someone. I knew that I had to find someone that I would want to spend the time with, who would not annoy me. And like, I kind of am a know-it-all. Like I know a lot of stuff. So I needed to pick someone who I felt like knew more than me. And so that's how I found someone that felt safe enough for them to point out my flaws.
So I already know you and the makeup of your friends, of your upbringing, all of that. How many of the therapists that were listed on there were people of color?
I mean, I think there were a few. There were a few that I messaged. I don't think that there were many that were on there who were people of color, but I don't think I messaged any men.
No, that I find different. And yeah. I asked this leading question because after having spent the week at EVA, I want to point out that for Kara and I, middle class white women, to access therapy with somebody, if it is that surface level, yeah. that's a face I want to talk to, how much harder it would be for populations who are underrepresented. Mm-hmm. Did I get all the syllables?
I think so.
Presented.
I'm thinking of Shrinking.
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
Oh my gosh. There are not women who look like me. So she is a younger black woman. And she says, there were not professors who looked like me. Nope. And so, yes, it is easier for us to find someone who we feel would relate to us. And we are aware of that. Mm-hmm. I mean, honestly, thinking about it, I would say there were 12 results on a page and maybe one of them would be a person of color.
Right. So how much harder would it be for someone who is of color or a different background or ethnicity or, you know, LGBTQ? Any of those, how much harder it makes it to find somebody that you would connect with that is a, quote, face that you would want to talk to. But I was thinking about that through EVA too, because, you know, that was something that came up a lot. Do we have victim advocates that are representative of the populations that we are serving? Is this somebody who they want to talk to? And it doesn't mean that, you know, men should not pursue those lines of profession at all. It's simply saying it may be harder for those populations to get the help that they need, even though they are more at risk for crime victimization if you look at the statistics.
So all of that to say, if you have an organization, if you have a resource, if you have a person who you recommend that we point people towards, that we highlight, that we let them talk about these issues, then please send them our way. Because as people who are always growing and learning and trying to do better ethically, societally, relationally, we would love to point you towards resources who can support these causes and educate us and all of you on these specific causes.
All right, Kara, it's almost time for you to go to Italy.
Yeah, Italy minded.
With that in mind, talk to us about solo travel.
Yeah, I know this is a question I get asked a ton. I'm sure it's a question you get asked a ton. How do you travel alone? Aren't you scared? And realistically, I think I have a healthy dose of dissociation, as we have established. If you've ever met me before, you've heard me talk about it. So I think there's a little bit of that happens as far as like, I know I'm fine. Like, what's the chances that I get attacked by a stranger twice in my life? Seems pretty rare. Right? If I had a nickel for every time, I would have two nickels.
Don't take my joke. I'm going to do it in the voice too.
Doofenshmirtz Evil Incorporated?
Yeah. No, but I think that realistically, I have a healthy dose of dissociation at any given point in time. And so I can be like, no, I'm fine. Like, what's possibly going to happen? But I also realistically do have a good bit of training on self-defense. And most specifically, I know the importance of situational awareness, which in reality is your number one defense mechanism against a perpetrator that is a stranger. It is being aware of your surroundings, paying attention to people, and listening to that gut instinct that says something is not right here. So I think having that and then having tools in my tool belt, like a hotel lock, like a flashlight, just different things that I can travel with that are TSA approved and just lend me a little more confidence. I think that those are my biggest tools in feeling safe and feeling comfortable traveling alone. But I'm not foolish and careless about it.
Yeah. Did you see, I haven't watched them yet, but there's a flight attendant who's going viral, I think this week. And she was showing all the ways that when she stays in hotels, how she makes it safe for herself to, like, whether it's shutting lights off, checking for cameras, you can use, you know, the pants hangers that you have in hotels to close your curtains so that they don't accidentally open. So there were a bunch of things that I just saw highlighted really quick as I was scrolling, and I want to go back and watch those.
I did see a video from this woman who she does a lot of safety tips. And I saw one recently that I loved, which is have an alias that is like a gender neutral name. And that's what you use whenever you go to like Starbucks or you put your name down for like an Uber Eats or a pickup order or something like that, especially when you're traveling. Because if someone sees, you know, delivery order for Kim or pickup order for Kim, they automatically are going to know it's a girl. So she said, you know, maybe it's a name like Blake Smith. And then they call it out at Starbucks and no one knows your name and is going to follow you. And I was like, that's freaking genius. That's
so smart.
I know. I love that so much. So another little, that's a freebie. You guys get that tip for free. You get those dog whines for free as well. Can't do anything about it. He's got feeling. He and Kim have feelings.
Ew, they're gross. A point you made about situational awareness too. Even when you are situationally aware, it does not mean that it can't happen. Let's entitle this segment, If Kim Had a Nickel. For those of you who don't know or don't know the sound, there is something from Phineas and Ferb with Professor Doofenshmirtz. The guy that voiced it and created this show is actually on TikTok and hilarious, but he goes, huh, if I had a nickel for every time that I've been doomed by a puppet, I'd have two nickels, which isn't a lot, but it's weird that it happened twice, right? So just so you're aware, that is what was in my brain moments after I have my second nickel. When I traveled to Indianapolis this February, it's taken me a little bit to get around to talking about this, but I was walking through a skywalk that connects these hotels at a conference. It was, you know, almost midnight or so after a really long day. There was somebody that was in the parking garage area that when he came into the skywalk, the enclosed skywalk area I was tracking, and he started approaching me really, really quickly. And I could see that he was approaching me based on my peripheral vision with the windows that were alongside of the skywalk. And because I was situationally aware enough, I had my phone up to my ear, but I wasn't actually listening on it. I opened up and had my back kind of so that there was no way for him to come up from behind me. Because one of the things that I learned when I was at the Sig Sauer Academy in New Hampshire filming a show for about 10 days was you want to face them head on, face first, have nothing in your hands. And so I had slipped my phone down in my pocket, which I had that time. Way to go, pockets. And that's the female gaze. Once again, we want pockets so that we can put things down and use our hands for combat if needed. Hello. And so I was ready if I needed to. This guy started coming at me and I spun right in time that he did not get his hands on me. But this group of four college kids came around the corner just at the right time. And I grouped in with them because otherwise I was completely alone. I had no idea where they were coming from, but I was booking it towards the sound of their voices. And they came around the corner at the right moment. I grouped in, circled back with them and walked out. Now, simultaneously as this was happening, there was a security guard from the hotel that had been tracking this guy. Apparently there had been some sort of incident that had happened previously and he started sprinting after him. The police had already been called. So I don't know still what the incident was, but they ended up arresting him at the other hotel that the skywalk connected to. He didn't get his hands on me, and I immediately started doing the things that we talk about or that I talk about that you're not supposed to do, where I had heightened adrenaline, and we're talking maybe 45 seconds of this, not a long period of time for all of this to take place. And I had heightened adrenaline, and I immediately felt that adrenaline dump. Historically, my coping mechanism that my brain has thankfully chosen just for me is to have a seizure, which sucks in a huge way. But using EMDR and therapy over the years has taught me kind of how, not necessarily to predict that they're coming, but to understand what could trigger an onset. And so I was able to start using tapping and really be present in what I was feeling as I'm having this massive adrenaline dump. The police came fairly quickly afterwards. I was there with hotel security, and then one of the people from the conference that I had been talking to minutes beforehand came up and sat with me, and I knew that I'm feeling really dysregulated, but I have to get the correct information to the officers. And it was kind of like that same panic response that I've had multiple times before, where there's a moment of crisis and I can operate fine during that time. And then the minute that I feel that there's safety or that I'm surrounded by safety, I'll lose my shit. And that's kind of what happened. I made it back to my hotel room after I was escorted there. I finally got a hold of Mike. His phone hadn't rang. I don't know why, but that's who I was trying to call as I was walking across. And I got on my first flight home, had to pay the enormous change fee to do so, but I knew I was not in good shape. If this was the first time that this was happening, I would probably have tried to talk myself down and say, it wasn't that big of a deal. It's not like he didn't actually touch you. What's the big deal about it?
Which is what you kept saying to me.
I know. And I
like trying to rationalize it. Mm-hmm. You told me about it pretty soon after, and you kept saying, but he didn't touch me. And I was like, it doesn't matter. I had to, like, you were trying to rationalize it, which I yep. find now amusing.
Right.
Because you know that's what everyone does.
Yeah. Even for us who sit here and talk about this, it's been our profession. We do this day in, day out. I still was trying to calm my brain down or make it make sense in my head and getting to the point where I'm like, it's not going to. It was completely random. So now I have two nickels. If I had a nickel for every time that I've been, what, traumatized by a stranger, I'd have two nickels, which is not a lot, but it's kind of weird that it happened twice, right? There you go.
There you go.
There you go. So even though I was trying to rationalize and downplay what happened, I knew enough about myself and my coping mechanisms to know that I needed to get into therapy, which I did that very next Monday. I flew home on Saturday morning first thing. Took some time during that day to just lay in bed. Mike took care of everything because, hey, I communicated and told him what I needed. I need to just decompress. I talked to you. I talked to one of my best friends, Kirsten, that was here. And then my parents, of course, knew. And I knew that for processing wise, I didn't want to answer a whole bunch of questions about it because it still didn't make sense in my brain. I needed to get into therapy. I needed to do EMDR because, hey, visual, I might not be able to have the words that go with it, but that EMDR helps me process those visuals and what I do remember from it. I was sober. I was doing all of the things that, you know, we will tell you to do to be situationally aware. And still, my body had the reaction that it did experiencing a different kind of trauma. And I am here to say that that is okay. It does not matter that this was a lowercase t trauma as opposed to my uppercase T traumas, but my body went through the same reaction because that's what it knows to do. So I was able to kind of stopgap that with the things that I've learned in therapy. And it was just this, hey, pat myself on the back. Maybe I'll put that on my award shelf. Gold star. I learned something from therapy and you can too.
Well, I think what's important here is, yes, you were doing everything right. But the thing that we tell people that you absolutely also did here is that you listened to that gut instinct that said, something is weird here. And you started kind of checking him out in your peripherals. You started using the reflections to keep your eyes on him. So instead of making alibis for a stranger, which we often do as women, you said, something's not right. And you put yourself on guard. So that's kind of the other piece of this is, yes, listen to your gut, but don't make alibis for people. If you make a stranger feel uncomfortable, but it makes you feel safe, who gives a shit? Like, mm-mm. You matter more than a stranger on the street. So don't be afraid you're going to upset them.
Right. One last thought on this would be, I have not shared up until now, even though this happened a couple months ago, because I wanted to make sure that it was indeed a scar and that I would not be experiencing other triggers from it so that I wasn't getting my, quote, open wound on everyone by sharing. So this is something that I have fully processed. It doesn't have to make sense necessarily, but it is processed in a way that doesn't trigger me and I can sit here and talk about it and just chalk it up and make some dark humor jokes about it and go on with my bad self.
Sounds great to me.
Sounds fine.
I love it. It sounds great. Sounds like a good, healthy way of dealing with things.
Totally.
I don't know of any other way, to be quite honest. There are professional fishers. There's a fishing tournament. So there's like fishermen, like in my front yard. Yeah. Get off my lawn.
You know that I really want to be there for this, right?
I'm sure you do. This is like a professional fisherman's haven. Like they're in a marked boat. So it's like a Berkeley Crest liner, like marked boat, you know?
Yeah.
It's pro level.
I used to watch fishing shows with my dad all the time.
Sweet Jesus.
All the time.
Why am I not surprised?
You know, I didn't know anything about football growing up, right? Literally knew nothing about football. And you'll appreciate this because Sundays in my home were for worshiping the left turn. And watching NASCAR races because that's what my dad watched. Yeah, NASCAR.
Yeah. That was like the only sport my parents even halfway paid attention to. I did not grow up in a sports household, but they did go to NASCAR races. And so now we are carrying the torch and passing it to our children and my family and I guess my husband gets to go too. Yeah. My family and I are going to a NASCAR race in a couple of weeks. And I'm like, this is gonna be fun. I can't wait. It's either gonna be really fun or it's going to be really terrible and they're going to hate it because of sensory overload. Either way, I'm going to enjoy it. So
take them some headphones. They'll be fine.
They actually get them. They get the headphones with the, there's like a family pack. They get the headphones. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That's really cool. All I can think of is Ricky Bobby. if you don't make all the quotes and jokes about that, I think that movie was so much funnier to me growing up with, like, we all love and adore Dale Earnhardt. Obviously. And it was like, this was like high time. I'm speaking to probably like six people right now, but it was Jeff Gordon. You're either team Jeff Gordon or you're team Dale Earnhardt. Yeah. And there's no in between.
Okay. Jeff Gordon was just like a little schmarmy, like, ew, who likes that?
Little twerp.
Yeah. And then you had like Salts of the Earth Earnhardt. It's like, yeah, I know.
Jim Corbin cried after that Daytona race, and all of the memorabilia, all of the Earnhardt flags still hangs proudly in their in their garage, along with the Illinois license plates.
Pardon this very random aside, but you know, it's, that's what we're here for. Like, my husband and I were like, we don't even know who races nowadays. Like, who do we even pull for? Who's our guy?
Who's Junior Series?
No.
Wait, what? No. I mean, I didn't watch anymore.
The only person whose name I recognized was like a Havard, one of the Havard boys.
Nope. See, that's it.
Like Rusty Havard, I think. I don't know. So I don't know anyone. And also, I was looking through like all the people who drive. I was looking at the drivers and I was like, why do like all these people look like absolute children? Like half of the roster is 22 and under. There is an 18-year-old.
Bring back the Richard Petties. Like,
there's an 18-year-old who is a NASCAR racer. I'm like, that is a literal infant. You guys are letting infants drive cars that fast? Not safe. He's like, I don't even have a license. Seems like you should have to be at least 22 to be a NASCAR driver.
At least you can have alcohol for a year before you can drive fast. I want to go fast.
Too bad you're not old enough. What does your mother think?
Damn it, youth.
Youths. Speaking of youths, another one we're gonna just turn it back around. I'm going to reel it back in. Another one of our listener submitted questions is about a listener's 12-year-old daughter. She said, my 12-year-old daughter has trouble falling asleep on her own for years because she's worried about an intruder. Given that you both have had such traumatic experiences, how would you or do you assuage such fears with your own children? She's too smart to believe a simple, it won't ever happen. There was a high-profile murder in our area that set this fear off, so she knows that terrible things do happen in the middle of the night. Well, I'm no parenting expert, and I have not experienced anything like this. I would say, from a healthy emotional standpoint, to a certain extent, you want to allow her the space to feel those feelings. And you don't want to say, well, that's not ever going to happen, because you don't know that. That's not a promise you can make. Mm-hmm. I think teaching healthy coping mechanisms and having conversations like, I understand you're worried. Here are the things that we do to keep you safe. Mm-hmm. What specifically are you worried about? What specifically could we do to make you feel safer? I think that conversations like that, I think that's fine with a 12-year-old. That would probably go a long ways with assuaging some of those fears. For her, that feels like the scariest thing that could ever happen. And just reminding her that no matter what happens, you will be there to help her get through it. I think that those are great things to have conversation around, Kim.
Yep. Well, I'm thinking back to what Mike said when he was on with us. Don't make promises you can't keep. And one of those things is recognizing with them, what are the things that we can control and what are the things that we cannot? And of those things that we can control, what are the things that would make you feel best? What can we do? So you can almost make an action plan. If your child is a visual learner like I am, write it down in a way that they can see and almost map it out. Not completely different. There was a time period where our daughter was scared. Like, which is so weird because homegirl has put herself to bed and like, I think I'm going to go take a nap now, and never been an issue with sleeping. But when she did have one, she felt like Mike and I wouldn't hear her or something. Now, our doors are literally right next to each other upstairs. And so what it took for her was Mike standing next to his side of the bed, and he put one foot in front of the other and they counted. Here's how many steps it would take me to get to the side of your bed, 13 steps. And so when she's nervous, she hears that in her mind. She's like, okay, 13 steps away. And then they like timed it. And it, of course, those are silly things. And those were for a 5 and a 6 year old about that time. So maybe it's not the same for a 12 year old. But there are those things that you can tangibly work through. And just giving them the space to have those fears, I think is really healthy. It's okay to be scared about them. It's not okay to let it control your every move.
I would also caution you against, I don't know how to say this yet. So I want to say my other point with the utmost love and respect for you as a parent, all of you as a parent, mm-hmm. and with absolutely no shame in this, monitor what she's consuming. Yeah. Because that fear, I don't want to say it's abnormal, but it is beyond the scope of what a 12-year-old generally is thinking about. So you said that there have been crimes like that near you. Just monitor what she's consuming on a regular basis, whether that be social media or YouTube Kids or video games or whatever, and assess if those things are lending to this fear.
Right. Well, and as somebody who, like, our kids know a lot about local crimes because it has to do with daddy's work. And they know it in a general sense, but you turn on the news, and I could imagine for this parent specifically, it's going to be all over the news, in newspapers, that's like coffee shop gossip or whatever it might be, but having those ongoing conversations and making sure that there's not anything piling onto it. When you're talking about monitoring content, I wish somebody, Deb, if you're listening, would have monitored me in third and fourth grade when I was bringing home scary stories to tell in the dark, because that shit still haunts my dreams. Please tell me you had those books at your library.
We did those, but, you know, I was of the America's Most Wanted and Unsolved Mysteries era. And so I think of like,
I'm sorry. The thought of you seeing those as a little kid and then being on it.
Yeah, girl. Listen, I mean, that this is a whole aside, but I will tell you, it probably did lend to my success, because somewhere in the back of my head, way too early, I had this thought like, if I ever get kidnapped, I know what I'm going to do. And damn it, I did it. So, you know, help her form an action plan. If this happens, this is what you do. You know, it could be a protection mechanism.
So wait, are we doubling back then on what we said about consuming true crime content?
No, I still don't think kids need to. You know, I had so many people on the comments of my videos on TikTok who were like, oh, I watched this with my 6-year-old. And I'm like, I don't know if that's appropriate. Like, yeah. Consider what you're consuming. But also, if it's already happened, it's happened, right? So form a safety plan. And I also like the idea of, I've seen some videos about, this goes back to us talking about situational awareness. I've seen some videos on how to teach kids situational awareness and mm-hmm. how it teaches them confidence. And so it's just kind of playing like people watching games, or, you know, you go to a restaurant and you're like, quick, you know, we've been in here for 5 minutes now. Tell me where the exits are. Like, close your eyes and point to the exits. Or you watch people who are, you know, you sit in a mall or you sit outside at a park or whatever, and you play little games with your kids like, okay, look at that person right there. If you had to guess based on how they look, what their job is, what would you guess? And so just kind of, it gets kids used to the idea of paying attention to people, how they move, how they dress, their, you know, their environment. So those kind of things also lend some confidence to kids. Mm-hmm. So maybe something like that would be helpful as well.
Yep. There's no right answer. There's also no wrong answer. Just, you know your kid best, and they know themselves best too. So give them the space to tell you what they need. So I know we still have a lot more outstanding questions, and we didn't get to a whole lot of them thanks to our random tangents, but we will continuously do these throughout the course of this show. So if you have questions that pop up, the preferred way to get those always is by emailing us so that we don't lose them. And it's hello@survivorsguidetotruecrime.com.
Yes, and we will be doing Q&As on our Patreon as well. That's something that for highest tier, we aim to do twice a month, but we are doing it for all patrons once a month. So bring your questions there. You'll get a lot faster service on your questions and support from our other patrons. Great conversations there. So we hope that you got some value from all of our rambling and our life in this true crime world and the things we picked up along the way. And we can't wait to do this again.
Yay. See you next time.
Bye.
Survivor's Guide to True Crime is hosted and executive produced by Kimberly Corbin Rourke and Kara Robinson Chamberlain. If you love what we do here, please don't forget to follow, rate, and review the show in your podcast player. It's an easy and free way to help us and help more people find the show. To learn more about the guests featured or to find resources and information discussed on the show, visit survivorsguidetotruecrime.com. Thanks for listening.
Well, see you later.
Six count nuggies.